Over the last several days, this country yet again is grappling with the reality and aftermath of a mass shooting. And the question of who and what is to blame. For millions of Americans, the answer lies in gun control. For others, it's about addressing America's mental health problem.
We have a lot of mental health problems in our country.
There's some pretty sick kids out there, and I think we got to do a better job of mental health.
This isn't a guns situation.
It seems like one common denominator is mental illness.
There's mental health and addiction issues.
We don't know right now exactly why this deranged individual did this.
People with mental illness are getting guns and conducting these mass shootings.
We've got to find out some way of getting those people into the FBI database so that they aren't able to buy guns.
By the way, we need to significantly improve mental health services.
I think that mental health is your problem here.
Today, we fact-check the claims that connect mental health illnesses to gun violence. Are mentally ill people more likely to commit violence? Is it fair to say they should be banned from having guns? Should mental health really be the focus after a shooting like we saw in Parkland, Florida? I'm Tanzina Vega, and today we unpack these questions on The Takeaway. With us today is Jonathan Metzl. He's director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and research director of the Safe Tennessee Project. Jonathan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we have a ton of things to unpack here, and I'm particularly interested in this narrative around mental health. I think this is one of the times that we, or one of the many times we hear about this, but this shooting seems to have brought this to the forefront. Is mental health, has mental illness or mental health, if you will, become a scapegoat to larger issues facing this country when it comes to firearms?
Well, it's a great way to start this conversation. And first, let me say just empathically, as somebody who studies this issue and also trained in mental health, that it's understandable to me why, as a society, we turn to questions of mental illness and mental health in the aftermath of these shootings. These shootings are unbelievably traumatizing. We try to divide a line between our own civilized society and somebody who would act with such disregard for human life. And of course, there are significant psychological histories for many of these high-profile mass shooters. And so in that regard, that turn is understandable as a national way of processing the trauma that we've experienced. But at the same time, people like myself who study this find it highly, highly irresponsible and really almost an abdication of leadership to just focus on mental illness from the top down for, I think, three main reasons. One is that, as we see in the Florida shooting, there are so many factors that might lead somebody who has a troubled history to commit an act like this. A second is that I can say as a psychiatrist, unfortunately, there's no psychiatric diagnosis whose symptom is shooting somebody else or harming somebody else. And I would challenge the leaders who are saying this is a mental health issue to tell us what is the diagnosis here. In a way, it's a concert of many factors, but it's not like somebody with depression or schizophrenia has one of their symptoms to go shoot somebody. And so in that regard, it's not like there's a predictive value of psychiatric diagnosis. And I think that's really a key issue, that it's multifactorial. And then I think the last part is, if you just look at the statistics of gun violence across the United States, people with mental illness are across the board more likely to be victims of crimes and even of shootings many times than are sane people in a particular way. And so in a way, what we're doing is we're playing an old stereotype and we're flipping it in order to give an easy answer that I feel like is not going to be effective.
I also wonder a little bit about the narratives that we have in this country, where we talk a lot about individual responsibility, right? And there were lots of calls at this after this shooting for individuals to have reported suspicious behavior to police. And in this case, the FBI had been warned about the shooter and admitted to failing to follow up. And the mental illness focus also seems to be very much on individual behavior versus sort of societal and collective issues. Right. What can we do to sort of change that?
It's so complicated, right? Because there are also people who were highly trained in seeing these kind of cases who were probably seeing thousands and thousands of cases in that regard. And so in that sense, there was no exact test. And it's important to also remember that those visits were happening in the context of a state where it's unbelievably easy for people 18 years and older to get semi-automatic rifles. And so to individuate this question in a way takes it out of the broader context of what I think people are pushing back on now, which is, yes, there are individual issues. And there are things that individuals can do. Many states have something called a gun violence restraining order, because I think the idea is basically people's families, their intimate partners, people like that, are good at predicting when somebody is going to escalate. So there are policies that some states try that look at that individual question. But again, the problem with it is when you take it out of the context of a bigger issue of just having so many guns around and having it be so easy, that in a way it puts an unnecessary onus on people whose job it is to keep us safe.
And speaking of people whose job it is to keep us safe, I'm wondering how prepared law enforcement is to really deal with this issue of mental health. It seems like we're just tossing around a term, but I mean, as you know, the way that we tend to deal with mental illness largely in this country has often been through criminality, right? It's often our jails have become our mental health providers. So are they prepared to deal with this? And if this is really such an issue, what does law enforcement have to do to improve?
Well, certainly I agree that we need more investment in our mental health system across the board. And I also agree that there are issues of incarcerating basically people with serious mental illness. Prisons become de facto mental health facilities. All of that is absolutely true. And at the same time, I feel like getting back to what we were talking about before, where is mental health expertise useful? It's useful in prevention, not in prediction. In other words, there's no psychiatrist who's going to sit down, or a law enforcement officer who's going to say, this one person out of the thousands that I see is going to go on to commit this act. We're nearing 40,000 gun deaths a year in this country. We are far and away number one in that regard. Also, most mass shootings don't make it to the news. Most mass shootings happen in areas where they're not quite as spectacular. They're not what's called white-on-white crime. And so in a way, what we're seeing is a small symptom, a very important one, of a bigger issue. And so I feel like, again, this gets back to the question of mental illness when people say, oh, it's just in one person's mind. There's nothing we can do about it. But I really feel like if we look at the broad patterns of gun violence in the United States, we know that there are a constellation of factors that respect people's gun rights on one hand, but will limit the trends that we're seeing. And I think really look at – just compare states that have tight gun laws versus ones that don't, and it kind of is self-explanatory.
You mentioned white-on-white crime, and I want to talk a little bit about the racially tinged labels that we often see around these mass shootings, particularly lone wolf, when the shooter is, say, white male. What impact does that have?
Right. Well, so I wrote a piece for the Washington Post a couple of months ago called When the Shooter is White After the Las Vegas Shooting, and it kind of addressed that same point, which is that there's a racial narrative that we tell. And just to summarize it, basically, when the shooter is white, it's often a lone, troubled individual or an individual mind. But when the shooter is a black or brown person, the story we tell is it's a pathological culture. So it links to this bigger ideology of sick black culture or terrorism, other factors. And so there are these different ways that we narrate mass shootings. Is it somebody's individual mind, or is it a cultural reflection? And in the piece, I kind of reflect on that and basically say that those two narratives lead to very different cultural responses.
And it also could potentially impact who and how folks who are mentally ill are treated if they are seen as a danger to themselves or to larger society. Jonathan, this is a very complicated issue, and thank you so much for being with us to talk about it.
Thanks so much. It was my honor.
Jonathan Metzl is director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society and research director of the Safe Tennessee Project.
Eu te peço a ti, Pai, no nome de Jesus, que venha levantar avivamento. Aonde que a tua presença?
That is a Brazilian prayer service for the victims of the Parkland shooting. Parkland has a population of approximately 31,000 residents, and among those, about 20% of people are foreign-born, with some who fled countries racked by violence. But even among this population, Wednesday's horror was unimaginable. Kayvon Antonio Hadari is a reporter with Reporters Without Borders covering the Caribbean and Florida.
Parkland is an enclave which has very high education levels, and a lot of people have come from other countries such as Germany, Mexico, a lot from Brazil, and other places where they found that in Parkland gave them a sort of a refuge of a sense of protection in a small community where it seems that they had everything all in an enclave, that they felt that they were protected. Some of the people said that before a car break-in was sort of like a big deal. Now this is a new reality.
And I'm wondering if before moving here, were any of the families you spoke to aware of other school shootings, including Columbine or Sandy Hook?
Some of them were, but of course, kids don't have the historical background to be able to process that. You know, for example, a lot of them came from other places. Joaquin Oliver, who was from Venezuela, he died, and his best friend Daniel Journey was looking for him to see if there were any news of him the night of the shooting. And he had no clue of the history of school shootings in the United States.
I honestly didn't know about that. I don't watch the news a lot because it makes, you know, I don't like looking at bad things. It makes me sad. But now thinking back, I probably should watch the news because something newsworthy happened to me today. And I hope people are watching me so I can give out the word to, you know, be safe.
Kayvon, I'm wondering if the families you spoke to, you mentioned earlier, they came here and they felt sort of protected by the enclave that they lived in, the community they lived in. But was it bigger than just the community? Was it coming to the United States and expecting something very different than what they've encountered in terms of their general safety?
I think you're right. For example, there's a lot of Brazilians that come from cities like Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, where sort of violence is sort of is a constant menace. Street violence, maybe petty street crime, and they tend to stay together, stick together with the people they know and the situations they know. It's sort of, imagine you're driving in a city where perhaps every intersection could be dangerous, and as opposed to driving in the interstate and all of a sudden a car comes down going in the wrong direction and you don't expect it. And I sense that this one for them is that interstate with the car coming and going in the wrong direction and all of a sudden getting hammered by this event.
Are any of these families that you spoke to deciding to take more extreme measures and just move out of the United States where this issue isn't such a daily or weekly or monthly occurrence?
I don't know about that. I haven't heard anybody that is thinking of uprooting themselves and finding a new place. Of course, they came here, set down roots, and I guess some will determine what they want to do in this situation. But I have a feeling that they feel that after this, you know, it's tough to be scared of anything. These kids have been shot at. What are they going to be scared of? Politics and anything else? The families, that's a different story. I don't know, but I presume some of them might be thinking of or have the means to have a second home in another place.
Kayvon, thank you for being with us today on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Kayvon Antonio Hidari is a reporter with Reporters Without Borders covering the Caribbean and Florida.